Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 64, The Devil's Alliance. Welcome to Episode 64 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. In today's episode, we're going to learn about a secret agreement that enabled the Nazis to begin the Second World War. It's the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and we're going to learn about it from the man who literally wrote the book about it, historian Roger Moorhouse, author of The Devil's Alliance, Hitler's Pact with Stalin, 1939 to 1941. Remember that you can get early ad-free episodes of Beyond Barbarossa through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you're comfortable with. Hello, I'm Scott Burry, podcasting as usual from the Red Beard Studio on traditional Algonquin Anishinaabeg land, also known as Ottawa, Canada. As I said, this episode is a conversation with Roger Moorhouse. He's the author of 7 books and is getting close to finishing his 8th. All are about Germany and Eastern Europe during the Second World War, and there are links in the webpage for this episode. With a master's degree in history and politics from the School of Slavonic and East European Studies of the University of London, Roger then studied at the universities of Dusseldorf and Strathclyde. He currently teaches a course on 20th century totalitarianism at the College of Europe in Warsaw. Roger collaborated and co-authored books with Professor Norman Davies on books such as Europe, a History, The Isles, a History, and Rising 44. Today, we're focusing on the Devil's Alliance and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Its significance in the first 2 years of the Second World War and beyond. So please join me in welcoming Roger Moorhouse. Good afternoon. First, can you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what you do?
Hello, Scott. Well, thank you for inviting me on. Roger Moorhouse. I'm a historian. I would say of Central Europe. I do have sort of a foot in the German camp. You know, I speak German. I used to live in Germany, and I have a very strong foot in, I suppose, the Polish camp further east from Germany. So that's my sort of twin passions historically. So I've always, or a lot of my books, I suppose, I've always wanted to explore that interface between the German world and the world to its east, whether that's the Baltic States or Poland. So that sort of explains where I come from. I studied history and politics at London University, and studied under the great Professor Norman Davies when I was there, a great scholar of Polish history. So he sort of helped guiding that sort of fascination with Central Europe in a more Polish direction, I suppose. I worked with Norman for a long time as a researcher after I finished university, and then on the back of that, co-authored with him, and then on the back of that, started writing my own books, and I'm now on number 8 Devil's Alliance, I think, was number 4. The current project, which I'm just finishing, is number 8. So, yeah, I sort of occupy a slightly peculiar world that, as I said, sort of straddles Germany and points east, but particularly with a focus on World War II.
Okay, great. And now we're going to talk about the Devil's Alliance, the German-Soviet non-aggression pact, and had a much longer name, official name. I think our listeners have a good understanding of what it was, but if can you just sum it up, the important points about the pact?
Yeah, it was signed on the 23rd of August 1939. Essentially, in very potted form, it gives a green light to Hitler to invade Poland a week later, which he does, thereby unleashing World War II in Europe. The pact itself, at first sight, and the way it was reported in the press at the time and publicized, was essentially a non-aggression pact.
Mm-hmm.
That was the sort of headline act of it, was that it was a German-Soviet non-aggression pact. It's generally named after its two primary signatories, who are the two foreign ministers, Vyacheslav Molotov for the Soviet Union and Joachim von Ribbentrop for Germany. So it's known as the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, sometimes Hitler-Stalin Pact by extension. The headline act of it, the non-aggression bit, is essentially a bit of a red herring. Okay, the two sides, who have basically hated each other and been fulminating against each other, certainly since the Nazi Party came to power in Germany in 1933, so for the previous 6 years, if not before, but the fact that they had signed a non-aggression pact between them, was that alone was astonishing to the outside world. It's a little bit like if you imagine the analogy of the United States and Iran, out of a clear blue sky, announcing, you know, the first day of the Trump administration, for example, let's say, they announce a non-aggression pact and an alliance of, you know, cultural and economic interest with the mullahs in Iran, right?
You didn't tell me you had a side interest in horror.
But it's that I'm trying to get to the how people felt at the time. That was the sort of level of shock that it brought with it. So the non-aggression pact bit is surprising in itself. They promised to basically, you know, solve their differences for a period of 10 years through negotiation and arbitration rather than violence. Okay, like there were countless non-aggression pacts in the 1930s. It was kind of the go-to of European diplomacy in that period. And most of them were either lapsed or were torn up when, you know, countries invaded each other. So, you know, as was this one.
There was a large amount of it was dealing with trade as well, promotion.
Yeah.
Trade between the two countries.
It was actually prefaced by a German-Soviet trade agreement, which was signed a couple of days before. This was particularly important. It was important for both sides, but particularly for the Soviets. So the Soviets saw that, you know, German technological advances, that the degree to which the German industrial and particularly the sort of second wave of the Industrial Revolution, so sort of chemical industries, particularly military and so on, high technology, optics, all of that sort of thing, that was an aspect that the Soviets really wanted to get hold of and they wanted to get into. So that they'd been very good at doing the first phase of industrialization, heavy industry, mining, steel working and that sort of thing. But that sort of second phase of industrial revolution, more technical, more sort of high skilled, was one that they had barely begun to do. So from a Soviet perspective, that's what they wanted into. So that was an important part of this political and strategic deal, was that they had essentially an economic treaty between them by which they would exchange raw materials going westward to Germany, oil particularly, grain, other things as well. But those are the two sort of headline aspects of it. And in return, the Soviets would get German high-tech and particularly military high-tech. So that was an important motivator. We're sort of, in a way, we're missing, I suppose, the key subtext of all of this was the strategic, that this was a strategic alignment. And when I talk about, you know, I talk about the book, called it The Devil's Alliance, Devil's S apostrophe, as I'm sure you noticed,
yes,
Scott, I always have to explain that when I speak to sort of students and, school kids, because those sort of niceties are a little bit lost on them nowadays. So two devils, right? This is an agreement between two devils. The strategic alignment between the two is really important. And it's the aspect that really, I think, people have signally failed to understand most grievously when they look at this. So when I'm talking about the Devil's Alliance, as I do with the title, and I talk about the Nazi-Soviet Pact, I'm not necessarily just talking about the treaty itself, or even the alignment that lay behind it, but I'm talking about that strategic alignment that went on for the best part of 2 years until the invasion of Barbarossa in the summer of 41. Okay, so that 2 year alignment, strategic alignment between the two, between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. And that's not overstating it to describe it as a strategic alignment. I think it's probably the most significant, we can call it an alliance in inverted commas. It was never an alliance, but it effectively is, right? Mm. I think it's one of the most important friendships, alliances of World War II, but that has been forgotten. I mean, it was more significant to Hitler than his alliance with Mussolini, for example.
Oh, okay.
I would say.
Now, an important part of it, too, was that there were secret clauses that were not promulgated or not announced outside of the meeting room.
Yes.
Correct. And that was the division of Eastern Europe into spheres of influence.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, this ties in with that strategic alignment. So essentially, this is Berlin and Moscow in 1939, dividing up a priori, because nothing has actually happened yet. So there's this thing called the secret protocol, signed at the same time between the two, as the name suggests, strictly kept secret at the time, which divided up Central Europe between the two, with the subtext, you know, in the event of a political realignment, i.e. when the shit hits the fan, essentially that we have war or whatever it is, then this is how things are going to, you know, fall into place. And this was very much, you know, within that sort of, the mentality of both sides, which was that, you know, we are great nations. Everything that's between the two of us are small nations that really don't deserve to be on the map at all. From the German perspective, that undeserving nature was racial in origin. For the Soviets, it's much more political in origin. Mm-hmm. But they, either way, they didn't deserve to be there. They didn't deserve to exist. So they deserve to be swallowed up by one or other side. So it completely fits with their respective ideologies.
But why did they keep it secret from, you know, the other major powers, Britain, France, the world, essentially?
That's a good question. I think the aspect that you're getting, or the sort of strategic alignment you're getting, is essentially those two powers aligning themselves against that outside world, right? Mm-hmm. We often forget, I think, that because the Soviet Union ended up on the Allied side as a, you know, absolutely key member of the Grand Alliance after 1941, as when it forms. I think we forget collectively that for the previous nearly 2 years, and for many of the years before that, before 1939, the Soviet Union was effectively a rogue state, and it was viewed as such. It was a revolutionary state. It had this ideology. It was willing and able to project its ideological power across the world through the Comintern, through various communist parties around the world, and it was actively through those organizations actively seeking to overthrow capitalism and spread its own influence and spread its own ideology. So it viewed the outside world as resolutely hostile, and it actually, this is why it's crucial to understand the Soviet view on this, which is very ideological in 39. You know, why do they switch that? Why do they switch to supporting Germany? They see an opportunity. Part of it's that economics that we're talking about, but it's also ideological. They are both revisionist powers. They both want to smash Versailles. And we always talk about Germany in that context, that Germany was the great revisionist power, right?
Right.
But we forget that actually the Soviet Union was just as revisionist and just as eager to overturn the international order that Germany was. So what this is in 1939 is effectively a revisionist alliance. You know, we're together, side by side. Okay, we come from different sides of the political spectrum, but there are areas of agreement. We can buy each other's complicity and silence with territory, with an economic agreement. But actually, what's at the heart of it is an anti-Western, an anti-status quo strategic arrangement. And that's, I think, is one of the key points that we collectively forget.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. Now, when did that secret part become known outside of Germany and the USSR?
In limited sort of circulation, it does almost immediately.
Oh.
It's interesting, there was a German junior diplomat, Johnny von Herwart. He was a junior diplomat, and he had seen the text, and he had communicated it to a good friend of his, who is an American junior diplomat. So this was, you know, even with the secret protocol, the text of it would have been known pretty soon.
Okay.
After signature. Problem was, it wasn't made public. You know, they sort of wait and see. By within a week, obviously, you've got the outbreak of World War II. And in a sense, I suppose, you know, there were bigger problems on the collective plate than, you know, the treaty that Germany and the Soviets had signed the week before. It becomes known publicly post-war. 47, I think it was, there was a publication put out by the State Department, which basically had the text of both the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which was common knowledge that had been publicized at the time, but crucially also the secret protocol.
Okay.
The Soviets persistently denied the existence of the secret protocol all the way up to 1991, because they viewed, I mean, that was fundamentally embarrassing. Okay,
right.
They created their own narrative after 1941. After the invasion, where they basically, the Soviet narrative was, well, you know, we made this arrangement with Hitler just to try and sort of buy some time,
right,
so that we can rearm, because we knew we were inevitably going to be attacked by this, you know, hideous creature and so on. So it was purely defensive in nature, and we would, and by expanding westwards like we did, taking the Baltic states, eastern Poland, Bessarabia and Bukovina from Romania, for example, attacking Finland as well. They said, oh, we were just buying ourselves land as a buffer zone and so on. So they created this rather elaborate narrative trying to explain what they'd been doing for the previous 2 years, which would really have been blown out of the water had they acknowledged the existence and the truth of the secret protocol.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really important for them to deny it. And that denial went all the way up. As I said, it was finally acknowledged under Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm.
In 1990, 1991, so that period of, you know, the second Russian Revolution, if you like, or the third, depending how you count them. Mm-hmm. And even, I mentioned it in the book, even Molotov, who had signed both documents,
mm-hmm,
was interviewed. He, I mean, astonishingly, he lived until, I think it was 1986. I think it was 1986 he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he was interviewed by a Soviet journalist in something like 1983, so not long before he died. And he was asked, you know, outright, he said, what about these rumors about this secret protocol to the Nazi-Soviet Pact? And he said, even then, you know, in advanced years and long out of politics and all the rest of it. But he said, well, of course, you know, I can be very clear on this. I was there. I was in the room. And he said, the rumors about the secret protocol are all lies. He said, of course, they're not.
Right.
You know, we've seen the document now. So even to the end of his life, he was maintaining this fiction that it was not true. So there's a sort of disparity there. So in the West, it was well known after that State Department publication after the war, whereas the Soviet world and the communist world was vehemently denying its existence all the way
right
up to 91.
Right. Now, there's just one little point I'd like to make, maybe respond to it, is that when I was doing the research on one of my episodes, I noted that the protocol was not signed by the Soviets until, I mean, there were negotiations, but it was not until after they were assured that Japan was no longer a threat on their eastern side did they sign the agreement.
Japan does play an important role in all of this, particularly in Soviet thinking, because they're stuck between, you know, two active enemies potentially,
right.
So they didn't want to get involved in Poland. That's one of the elements that influences their delay in going into Poland in 1939, mm-hmm, because they wait, of course, until the 17th of September. And part of that logic is that they wanted to make sure that the Japanese in the East had been, you know, adequately dealt with, had their teeth pulled, which they did have at the Battle of Khalkhin Gol. So that was, once that battle had been, you know, effectively won by Zhukov, incidentally, under Zhukov's oversight, then they thought, okay, now, so that threat is gone. Now we can afford to go into Poland, you know, with a secure rear. The other key element in that timing issue, of course, is to avoid the opprobrium that would inevitably result, the sort of the outrage in the outside world, that they had, you know, in direct concert with Nazi Germany, invaded
right
a sovereign state. So they managed to dress it up. And this is a very sort of important book, part of the book, is how they dressed up their invasion, and it was an invasion, as police action or an intervention or, you know, trying to secure the rights of dispossessed and distressed minorities in Eastern Poland and so on. So they used all sorts of sophistry to try and dress it up so that it didn't look like, you know, a military invasion, which is what it actually was.
They said they were protecting the Belarusians and the Ukrainians in Eastern Poland.
Yes, exactly. So again, I think where we've collectively gone wrong with our perception of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, in the West at least, in the English-speaking world, is that we really, for one thing, it wasn't part of the collective Western narrative. So the Western narrative has, you know, Germany invading Poland in 1939, Britain and France respond, declare war. You've got the phony war, everything else. Everything kind of flows from that. So it's quite easy. And then in that Western narrative, you know, there's the Finnish war, which might get in it, get a, you know, winter war might get a flicker of recognition from Western minds at the time. But really, I mean, it was actually quite big at the time, but since sort of disappeared from the narrative. Baltic states, not really, unless you're from the Baltic states or you marry someone from the Baltic states, you don't have that narrative. Right. And the same thing with Poland to a large extent. So, you know, we have our narrative, and it really, it's quite parochial. I think Brits tend to want to see themselves as being very, you know, open to other narratives of World War II, particularly in the modern period. But I think our outlook and a lot of the teaching particularly is very parochial. And we need to sort of get away from that. So that idea that, you know, Hitler is the greatest, the worst, you know, villain of the 20th century or of history itself. We have to some extent, elevate Stalin into the same category.
Well, again,
and we collectively failed to do that.
I think possibly partly because the USSR was the ally of the West after 1941. So you have to
absolutely right.
You know, the narrative that you're spinning has to justify that somehow.
So I mean, just an illustration of that. When that book came out, which is now 10 years ago, I did the usual promotional sort of tour and gave various talks and so on. And there was one of those talks that I gave, you know, have a Q&A at the end. And this elderly man stood up and he was very polite, but the essence of his question was, how dare you say nasty things about Stalin? So, you know, he was either...
10 years ago?
This was 10 years ago. Yeah. So this was either someone who perhaps had himself been a communist. That's quite possible, you know, soused in the propaganda.
Yeah.
Or it's someone of the wartime generation for whom Stalin was not the, you know, the sort of the saber-toothed ogre that many in Central Europe remember him as, but he was Uncle Joe. He was the cuddly guy that sort of sat on the sofa with Churchill and smoked cigars, you know, and was held up in British and American propaganda as a great statesman and, you know, all of that sort of very positive stuff, which was necessary for the maintenance of the Grand Alliance.
Right.
But those attitudes obviously persisted. And to try and sort of challenge them with history and with facts is sometimes a tough job because, you know, those ideas get very deeply ingrained.
Right, right. I just remember the cartoon that I saw in my high school history book of Hitler and Stalin bowing and greeting each other over a devastated Poland, you know. And
The famous David Lowe cartoon. Yeah.
Yes, and I'm going to put that into the webpage for this episode. So as we're changing tape reels, hit the follow or subscribe button on your website, and then you can refill your coffee or water or beer or vodka or whatever you're drinking, and come back, and Roger and I will be ready for you in just a few moments. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian man, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. It comes in three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. The Eastern Front Trilogy
is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941 through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find 3 individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase the 3-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back. Before we start the conversation again, just take a second and you can click on the subscribe or follow button on your podcasting app if you haven't done so already. Thank you. Now, we're back with Roger Morehouse and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So you mentioned the phony war. So after Germany invaded Poland, Britain and France declared war on Germany, but not on the USSR.
No.
And but they, for months, they did very little except talk and send sternly worded diplomatic notes. But did the pact, the non-aggression pact, play into that delay in action?
By the British and the French?
Yes.
No, it really doesn't. The British and French unwillingness, or the failure to, we could say the failure to declare war on the Soviets. So they both agreed terms with the Poles. The French had a full-blown military alliance. British and the Poles had a military agreement, which was signed on the 25th of August. Certainly the text of the British military agreement said that, you know, should, as you know, as these treaties tend to be phrased sort of anodyne in their wording. The wording of that, I paraphrase, was basically, in the event of attack on Poland by another power, you know, Britain will come to Poland, or come to Poland's aid with, you know, all means at our disposal or whatever it was. But it didn't specify Germany. So a lot of people at the time, and this was a question at the time and since, you know, I've been asked this a lot, why didn't the British, if that was the text, you know, if another power attacks Poland, why didn't they declare war on the Soviets? The short answer is both a political one and a strategic one. The political one is that the text, as I said, was anodyne and was deliberately vague, but there was also a secret annex. So it was all about secret annexes to treaties, all of this. There was a secret annex to that agreement between the British and the Poles, which said, oh, by the way, when we talk about another power, we're talking about Germany.
Right.
So they're not specifying it in the public text of the treaty. They're putting it in a secret annex.
Okay.
So basically, this is not, you know, transferable to other powers. We're just talking about Germany here. And actually, it was Chamberlain at the time had to respond to questions in the House of Commons. In September 39, this was raised, you know, why aren't we declaring war on the Soviet Union after the 17th of September? And he basically explained it to the House of Commons at the time. So that response we have, again, collectively forgotten. So that was the sort of political reason. The strategic one is that I don't think there was any particular will to declare war on the Soviet Union. And for two reasons. The first one being sort of precautionary. You don't really want to jump into declaring war on you know, a territory of the size and potential, I would stress the word potential, of the Soviet Union, lightly. So you're not going to jump in and do that lightly unless you absolutely have to. And I think there was a general feeling, given how surprised, you know, Western capitals had been, and even the British Secret Service had done a report about a week before the Nazi-Soviet pact was signed, for the British government. It's because we knew that they were talking, right? So we were talking to the Soviets as well. And we knew that the Germans and the Soviets were also talking. So this report was commissioned, and it came back and basically said, there's no prospect of the Germans and the Soviets finding common ground. It's just impossible. So much for Secret Service intelligence. Mm. But I think there was a general feeling on the back of the pact that, all right, that happened. And yeah, Poland is being collectively sort of, you know, thrown to the wolves. But we don't see that this strategic arrangement really has legs because of the ideological contortions that have been necessary on both sides.
Right.
So I think it's quite, in that sense, it was quite realistic that this wasn't something, you know, in the long term, we don't have to go into bat against this. This is going to burn itself out as it goes. And it did.
Right. Yeah. It couldn't live that much longer than it did.
No, exactly. Problem for British and French diplomacy in 39 is they still expected that if they raised their voices enough and signed the necessary agreements and alliances with Poland, that Hitler would back down. Problem was that Hitler was no longer listening to them. He held them all in contempt by September 39. So he was just saying, you know, I'm not listening to you. I'm just going to do this. And he was convinced that they were going to back down, that they weren't going to declare war. And as it was, they declared war and made all of the right noises in supporting Poland, essentially did pretty much nothing. There is British bombing of naval sites, for example, military sites, leafleting of big urban areas of Western Germany, which is, doesn't really do anything.
Mm.
And the French launched their Saar campaign in the middle of September, which doesn't really do anything.
No, because they withdrew.
Effectively it. Because they withdrew very quickly.
Yeah.
And you're left with the British and the French basically coming to the conclusion that essentially Poland is lost. We can't materially support Poland. So what we have to do, knowing that we are going to be next on the menu, is to sort of gird our own forces and harbour our own forces, which is what effectively they choose to do. But the shame in that is that they didn't inform the Poles of that decision having been made. So the Poles are still fighting on in the expectation that the British and the French were coming, and the tragedy was that they weren't, and they never were. If I can, just Scott, I just want to come back on one thing, talking about, you know, those British and French perceptions, which I think is significant. As I said, there was a sort of general sense that this was a shock, and they didn't expect that that alliance, as it were, again, in inverted commas, between Berlin and Moscow had legs. But at the same time, it is significant to mention, in case there's anyone out there that, that does know this stuff, they'll be kind of, you know, getting out the green pen to write you an email. There was a plan afoot, an Anglo-French plan called Operation Pike in, when was it, winter of 39, early 40. Contingency plan initially. There's, you know, there are always contingency plans. They're all over the place. And a lot of them are red herrings because we find them in the archive and we go, oh my God, look at what they were planning to do. Well, they have contingency plans for everything. But this one was actually put into action. So this was a... the plan for a bombing raid on the Soviet oil fields of the Caucasus. You know, so Baku, Azerbaijan, and so on, which is, you know, were the main Soviet oil fields. And also, I think it was at Batumi in Georgia. And they were to fly from bases in Persia, in Iran. So what sets this apart from a mere contingency plan is that they actually had the aircraft ready. They had moved aircraft into place to carry this out, right? Which makes it a little bit more than just a random contingency plan. They were planning to do this in the spring, early summer of 1940. It was all planned out. And the logic was that they viewed the Soviet Union as the sort of soft underbelly of this grand, what it was described once by a British journalist as Teutoslavia, you know, this grand unit that ran from the Rhine all the way to Vladivostok. Right, so they saw it almost as one entity, which rather contradicts, I entirely accept, contradicts what I said before. But this, I suppose, shows you that, you know, you can have many prongs to a policy and many, many different contradictory ideas in your head at the same time. The raid never happened. It was, you know, events were overtaken by the German invasion of France in May 1940. So it never happened. But it's interesting to, you know, just bear that in mind, that there was some strategic thinking that viewed this as potentially a permanent thing, and viewed the Soviet Union as the soft underbelly of Hitler's Reich.
Well, that's fascinating because I never came across any hint of that in any of the books I've read. And that's fascinating. And that's where we'll have to pause this episode. Roger Moorhouse and I have much more to talk about, including the strained relationship between the two tyrannies of Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, the tensions that frayed their relationship, the signs that the world, and especially Stalin, should have seen, and how it finally, spoiler alert, fell apart. We also discuss the longer-term impacts and implications of the Nazi-Soviet pact. The good news is that you'll only have to wait 1 week, not two, which is usual for Beyond Barbarossa. That's right, listeners. You're all getting lots of extra content. Patreon supporters will, of course, get the next episode even earlier and ad-free. So, if that's what you want, early access and ad-free content, go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support that you want. As always, I've put photos and links to Roger Moorhouse's books on the webpage for this episode. Check them out. And while you're doing that, remember to hit the follow button on your podcast app. And if you have a couple more moments to spare, a rating or a review would make a world of difference. If you have even more time to spare or something to say, send me an email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or leave a comment on the Facebook page, Beyond Barbarossa. Or, even more ors, contact me on Blue Sky at scottthewriter.bsky.social. I'd like to take a moment to thank the latest, at time of recording, Patreon supporters, Ed Morley, Bill Hall, Tom Gaffney, Craig Duncan, PFE, Elliot Goldman, and Gavin Edwards. You make this work so much easier. And also, thank all of you for listening. Remember to come back in 7 days. For most listeners, that will be 13th January 2025. Same Barbarossa time, same Barbarossa channel. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Berg. I'm Scott Murray. Until we meet again, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina I Heroyam Slava. We'll be right back.